Hi, this is Aaron Newcomb, and on this episode of Floss Weekly, Guillermo Amaral joins me to talk about libcloud. It's a Python library that you can use to configure any cloud that you can think of. It's coming up right now on Floss Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Aaron Newcomb and Guillermo Amaral, episode 373, recorded on February 2nd, 2016, libcloud. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Braintree. Even the best mobile app won't work without the right payments API. That's where Braintree V.0 SDK comes in. One amazingly simple integration gives you every way to pay. Try out the sandbox and see for yourself at braintreepayments.com/floss. And by DigitalOcean. Simple and fast cloud hosting built for developers. Deploy an SSD cloud server in 55 seconds. Try it today for free. Visit DigitalOcean.com, and once you sign up, be sure to enter the promo code FLOSS in the billing section to get your $10 credit. Welcome to Floss Weekly, the show about free Libre open source software. I'm Aaron Newcomb, your lovely host today. And as always, we also have a lovely co-host, and today that's Guillermo Amaral. Guillermo, how's it going?
Yes, Aaron. I see you removed my lovely title this week, which is okay, I guess. But I think I look extra lovely today, so I'm just saying.
You do look lovely. I figure we can both be lovely. I'll be the lovely host. You can be the lovely co-host. And, you know, everybody's happy that way. No one gets offended.
Okay.
Yeah, we also have a lovely guest coming up in just a little bit. But before that, Randall's away, as you can see. So I'm filling in for Randall, and hopefully he'll do an okay job. It's always fun to host the show, especially when we have cool topics like today. We're going to be talking about libcloud, which I guess is combiner API, if you will, to interface all the various public cloud offerings. It's a Python library, actually, and you can use it to I guess set up compute nodes on various cloud service providers and stuff. We'll find out, I guess, when we talk to our guests. But Guillermo, do you know anything about libcloud, or just cloud in general?
I obviously know about cloud, but I have never heard about libcloud. So this is going to be super interesting for me. I did obviously read up a little bit on what they do. And it does seem to be like an aggregation library, I suppose. But I guess our guest will explain exactly what it is.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is something that for me is very interesting when you can programmatically, and of course there are APIs for each, you know, various cloud service provider, but to have one, especially written in Python, that makes it easy to set up, you know, various normalize the way you set up your cloud instances and things like that across, you know, different providers, I think is really interesting. So we'll find out more about that in just a minute when we bring on our guests. But first, we've got to thank a sponsor. So let's start out by thanking Braintree. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Braintree. Even the best mobile app won't work right without the right payments API. That's where Braintree's V.0 SDK comes in. One amazingly simple integration gives you every way to pay. Try out the sandbox and see for yourself at braintreepayments.com/floss. No matter what payment type, Braintree accepts it. Apple Pay, Android Pay, PayPal, Venmo, credit cards, even Bitcoin. And if there's something new that pops up, Braintree will automatically support that too because they've got great developers. It's the same payment solution used by Uber, Airbnb, GitHub, so you know it scales and scales well. It provides simple, secure payments and code that you can integrate in minutes. If you don't have time, you can just give them a call and they'll handle everything for you. They'll do all the integration, walk you through the process, whatever you need. They've got great support and they include Android, iOS, JavaScript clients, so you can, any way you want to program, you can make it work. The SDKs are actually in 7 languages: .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, and Ruby. So no matter what you like to program in, they've got you covered. They provide elegant code with clear documentation. And in 10 lines, you can create your code to develop your app. It's really incredible. Braintree gives you an easy way to accept multiple payment types with one integration. Integrating it into your app is as easy as inserting a few lines of code. So try out their sandbox and see for yourself at braintreepayments.com/floss. That's braintreepayments.com/floss. And we thank them for their support of Floss Weekly. All right, so let's go ahead and bring on our guest, Anthony Shaw. Anthony, are you there?
Hi, good morning.
Hey, yes, good morning. Now, is it good morning for you? Where are you speaking to us from?
I'm speaking to you from Sydney, Australia, and it's definitely the morning. It's about 4:30 a.m. here.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Well, thanks for, making the sacrifice to talk to us today. We're excited to talk to you about LibCloud. How did LibCloud get started, and what's your role in the project?
So LibCloud was started in 2009 by a private company called CloudKick. And this company was set up to do cloud monitoring, to monitor some of the different public clouds as a service. One of the main developers on that project was also an Apache member, and he is a guy called Paul Kerner, and he said that they should keep that part of the logic separate and keep that open source. The rest of the project was closed, but they kept the integrator, the thing that talks to the different clouds, as a standalone project, and that was always kept as open source. He also worked on making that an incubator project with Apache, where it remained for about 2 years until in 2011 it was promoted to a top-level project. So Apache LibCloud is one of the 100 or so Apache projects, official Apache projects. And shortly after that, CloudKick was acquired by Rackspace, and they took some of the CloudKick IP and pulled it apart and integrated it into other places. So I guess LibCloud kind of stuck through that whole process, by being part of the Apache project and also being open source.
Awesome. And your role, you've always been with the project, or when did you get started?
I've only been involved for about a year. LibCloud supports 52 cloud providers, and I work for one of them. So I work for Dimension Data. I was initially involved just looking at how we integrate our cloud solution into LibCloud. So I worked on what we call a driver and doing the integration with that. And just, I guess, as I got more and more involved in the project and helping out other people in the community who were trying to add drivers and add features, my involvement kind of exploded to the point where I was helping do code reviews and pull requests. And then I was voted in as a PMC member, which is an Apache thing. It means the project management committee. So there's a team of, in this case, about 6 people who have sort of the voting rights over the project and guide the project through different releases and also make sure the community is engaged.
Awesome. Awesome. So now tell us what actually LibCloud is. What does it do? I tried to give a description at the beginning. I don't know if I could have completely messed it up, but was I close in my description?
Yeah, no, very close. I know a couple of you work on sort of integration, like makerspace tools. Mm-hmm. And you get those power packs. And then in terms of actually plugging it into the board, you can choose between about 30 different plugs. And each one, if you're going to plug in like a DC power supply into one of your IoT devices, you just need a negative and a positive port. It's pretty straightforward. But there's about 30 different ways of plugging it in. In terms of the cloud, early on, each of the cloud providers, as you said, do have APIs, but that didn't really mean that they were easy to use. A lot of them, for example, Amazon's early versions were XML. In terms of how you do the encryption, you have to go through a special algorithm that takes the payload and the headers and encrypts it based on the time and the types of users, and the whole thing was really quite complex. Other cloud providers did have an API, but they had no documentation for it. So there's a couple of issues that it was trying to solve, one of which was that to make it easy to consume these clouds and to automate them without having to just go straight to the API. So we kind of provide that simplification. The other is that if you do consume a particular cloud, so let's say you're just using Amazon or you're just using Azure, and then if you're using LibCloud as the mediator, it gives you the freedom to move between different cloud providers. And that has come in helpful for some of our users. In the next release, actually, I'll say we support 52. We'll actually be supporting less in the next release, probably about 48, because four of those have shut down. So another thing it protects you against, I guess, is these companies who make this big investment, they set up this public cloud with a proprietary API. You do all the hard work of integrating into it. And then they announce, in the case of Ninefold, which is an Australian provider, HP Helion, their public cloud, is shut down last month. They were given about 3 or 4 months' notice to users. So if they did code against those APIs, then really they would kind of be left in the lurch. If they'd have used LibCloud in the first place, really they could just switch to another provider. So the project is a Python library at its core, and it provides a set of simple interfaces to consume things like compute, so that's creating virtual machines, and they can either be in the public cloud or the private cloud. So public would be things like Amazon EC2, Azure, and some of the other major providers like Dimension Data, for example. On the private side, that could be things like OpenStack. So if you've got your own OpenStack cluster, it could just be a VMware box. It could just be libvirt. So it could be your laptop and you're just running just some basic hypervisor. We also support storage clouds, DNS, as well as load balancing. So if you want to automate creating load balances in the cloud, you can also do that.
So would this be something I could use? I mean, load balancing was one thing I was going to ask about. So would this be something I could use where I'm monitoring my application and I see that I'm running out of compute for my application? I could use this to automatically spin up a new node, either on the same service provider or using a different service provider, and add that to a cluster automatically to kind of, you know, scale my application up and down as I need it to work.
Yeah, sure. One of the use cases actually we talk about and that our users adopt quite well is the idea of being able to pick the best tool for the job. So because we support compute, load balancer, DNS, storage, and shortly container cloud as well, it means you can decide which cloud provider you want to use for each of those components. So DNS, for example, let's say your public cloud provider has a great VM service, but it doesn't have a DNS service. So you can use LibCloud to automate the DNS piece and the compute piece in the same process. In the kind of examples you're talking about are what we call continuous delivery. So that's where you want to get your application off your laptop, off your dev environment and into the cloud. So you can write a script in Python using LibCloud to provision the VMs, deploy them, run some extra tasks in SSH, or in the case of Windows, you can also use WinRM. Then in terms of storage, you can set up a storage blob, upload your bits, so your application. You can create a load balancer, you can set up the DNS records, and then you can basically tile that together in one piece at the end. There are also some, I guess, commercial products that use LibCloud under the covers. So in cases where we have these online multi-cloud management portals, really those providers, most of those software vendors anyway, try and use a project like LibCloud. There are others. LibCloud is the biggest one for Python. There's one for Java called JClouds, which is also an Apache project. There's one for Ruby called Fog. And most of these kind of cloud management portals use these libraries under the covers to talk to these different clouds. It's a lot of, I guess, overhead to keep up with the different providers. I say we support 52. The majority of our changes and code changes are just those vendors changing their APIs month by month. There is a lot of change and there's a lot of new features coming out from each provider. So it's a lot of work for the community to keep up with that. So it's a really strong advantage, I guess, to leverage something like LibCloud where all of that effort's already been done. If you went ahead and tried to do that yourself and tried to write a script which worked across Azure and Amazon, for example, then you'd have to keep up with every time Amazon changed their APIs or come out with a new feature, which is pretty regular.
Yeah, that's definitely something I really like about this, is because especially since the cloud is changing so frequently, you know, I mean, Amazon might come out with some new pricing thing tomorrow or some feature that or some bug or something, and you don't want to use Amazon anymore. This makes it really easy to switch back and forth between different providers without having to necessarily change your code too much. And the code is one thing that I really like. It's really at least simple. I was looking at the website. Maybe John can bring this up for you. Right on the main page, you've got some great examples of how simple this is to write and do things like create a node or in this case configure DNS or whatever. Now I'm assuming that in terms of the compute types, you've got for example, if people are familiar with Python, so you're importing a provider from libcloud.compute.types. I'm assuming that provider would be something Amazon AWS or something like that, right? You would change that provider to match whatever provider you were using. And then at that point, everything should be consistent throughout your procedure, correct?
Yes. So there's a small caveat to that. I spend a lot of my time reading API documentation, unfortunately. And the only way I can describe it is that every time a new provider wants to create an API, the designers, the developers sit in a room, close the doors, turn off the internet and say, "Oh, okay, let's design the perfect API. Let's just ignore what everyone else has done and we're going to do it right this time." So there's like next to no consistency between different providers. Everyone has their own strange little ways of doing things. And authentication is definitely one of those. So the example you showed, I guess, the thing that isn't consistent between the providers is the way you authenticate. Once you've created an instance, like a class in Python, then you can basically use the same methods throughout. So there's a collection of base methods that work across all drivers. Simple things like list nodes, create node, deploy node. In this case, a node is a virtual machine. And then in DNS, it's very simple. Things like get record, get zone. So it's a very flat class structure in libcloud, which makes it really easy to use. So I wouldn't say you need to be a Python expert by any means. If you can just kind of find your way around Python, then it's a very easy API to use. A credit to the original designers, I guess. And also, it's made it very much simpler to consume these cloud providers. Because like I said, not only did they make the API complicated, but they also introduced all these new concepts. So each cloud has its own way of wrapping up the VMs. Some of them call it projects, pods, clusters. There's about 20 different names for more or less the same thing. So the drivers in libcloud kind of do the hard work of figuring out, okay, you just want to list nodes. That's all you want to do. You want to know how many VMs you've got, what they're called, whether they're off or on. And, you know, the drivers do the hard job, I guess, of figuring out, okay, is he talking about clusters, pods, environments, project codes, and kind of talking to the APIs and then doing that hard work for you. The way it works basically is we have a generic method called getDriver, which is a factory method, and you give it a provider name. So in that example, that was Rackspace. You could give that EC2, you could give it Dimension Data, OpenStack, and it would basically return back a reference to the class, and then you can just run the constructor on that class with the authentication details. Like I said before, authentication can be quite complex. Some providers require that you have private certificate keys. Some of them require that you have API keys. Some of them are username passwords. So it's kind of a different process for each one. But once you've created the class instance, then it's plain sailing from there.
What if I want to keep those details private? Is there a way to, because I see where you can, looking at your example code, where you can provide your username, API key, and so forth. But, you know, in order to keep things private, passwords and things like that, potentially in a shared development environment, I mean, how would you do that?
Yeah, the best method, if the provider supports it, is this concept called API keys. So in the what you really shouldn't do is run your automation as yourself. So if you think about your script, which creates your application, creates your environment, having that login as Aaron doesn't make a great deal of sense because it's not actually you doing the work. So if you went and looked at the logs and you said, why was Aaron creating VMs at 2 a.m. when he was probably asleep? It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And also the rights that you'd give Aaron, the user, versus the rights that you would give that application might be different. So most cloud providers these days support a concept called API keys, where you kind of create a pseudo user. So let's call that user deployer, and you give it a specific set of rights. So it's allowed to only do the things that you want that script to do. And then it normally generates a very long and complex key as the password. So you would normally use deployer and that long complex key as the credentials. And then you can save those in the script. And all that means is that if other people can get access to that script, all they can do is do the same things the deployer can do, which they could do by running the script anyway. The other way you can do it is you can put the credentials in a separate file and you can basically just reference them from the main script. So you can have a private file, which we call a secrets file, and then you can reference them in the script instead of putting them, hard coding them, I guess, in the instance.
Right, right. So the same way you would do for other, you know, passwords and things like that, that you would be scripting out. You mentioned that you could use this for private cloud too, I believe. And I guess the only thing that you would need there is just to make sure that they provided the same API as the, you know, whatever one you want to use, right? They would have to be consistent on their API implementation, correct?
Yeah, sure. So it is a great use case. And in terms of definitely in the community, I think some of the big companies that use our product, it's not really a product, it's an open source project. Some of the bigger companies that consume this, really, they have a lot of virtual machines in the public cloud, and then they've got either a legacy or a whole load of development environments or applications that can't move to public in their private cloud. So private would be something like OpenStack, for example, mm-hmm. or VMware vSphere. We have been doing some research recently to understand what the makeup is of the private space, and the majority, I think, VMware has a pretty big market share in this still, especially in the sort of medium to large enterprise space. So VMware kind of makes up most of that environment. But the place we're particularly interested in at the moment is people running stuff on their laptops, which might sound strange, but for example, containers, a report came out yesterday saying that 54% of containers run on people's laptops. That was from Brendan Burns, who's one of the lead engineers on the Kubernetes project. So I think sometimes we overcomplicate things and think about, oh, you know, we need to figure out how to integrate OpenStack into EC2. But a lot of the time it's developers who are creating a virtual machine. They've kind of figured out how to automate that. And they've done it on their laptops first. And also in terms of students, and you know, younger developers who may not have the budget to spin up all these instances in public cloud, it's important that we don't, you know, isolate them. And I think that's one of the important things about using a project like this, is that public cloud is great when you have a commercial budget behind you and you work for an organization. But if you're doing things off your own wallet, then it can get expensive really quickly. More recently, I was testing one of the new Amazon features, and just they don't provide a test API, so you can't call like a test API to get responses and examples back. You have to call the live one. So in order to write the driver, I had to basically instantiate a whole bunch of containers and clusters, and just in the process of developing it, it costs me about $500. So if you were a student or you were just starting out, then, you know, that'd probably be a significant amount of money. So one of the things we don't want to do with this is to, I guess, only create a whole bunch of cool automation deployments and stuff in public cloud where people necessarily can't afford to deploy into. If you've got resources in your house, in your office, you know, you've got a spare laptop lying around, and you want to reinstall that and play around with OpenStack, then by all means, you know, libcloud can still be used. This is not just a, you know, an enterprise thing, people who are consuming the cloud in big ways. So we don't want to isolate those people. And I think a project like this as well goes a long way in trying to kind of provide that functionality. One thing that I was discussing with the other PMC members actually is that it's kind of scary now how, especially in the open source world, open source projects, let's say 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it was about trying to get off proprietary ecosystems and proprietary platforms. So, you know, Linux came about very early on because there was a whole bunch of licensing constraints and issues around Unix and SCO, and that whole battle, which I'm sure some of the readers would be well aware of. In terms of Java and the whole argument about getting Java open source, not using something like some of the Microsoft tools like .NET, for example. But more recently, .NET's become open source. In terms of the software, I think things are becoming more and more open. People have understood that it doesn't make sense to purely license the software. It's actually the service you're providing and the platform you're providing. However, things have kind of swung the other way now, where you've got these huge cloud providers like Amazon, and you know they've got a great platform. They've got some great features. But they have a huge amount of the market share. It's, I think at the moment it's like 80% or something. And just in terms of the number of features and functions in their cloud, they're miles ahead of anybody else. And even open source projects are building on Amazon and saying, okay, our project is open source. It's completely open, but it can only run in the Amazon cloud. So they're saying, you know, we'll consume Amazon's queuing service, Amazon's database service, Amazon's XXXXX, and they'll be taking out these PaaS providers. But really, how open is that? And in terms of the open source community, and I think the things that we've been fighting for so long, we kind of seem to be handing a lot of that away to these new providers. You know, obviously they're doing this to make money and they have a great platform, but I think something like libcloud is really important for protecting the community and protecting the open space, for not tying ourselves to a commercial product and a commercial platform. And I think compute platforms and PaaS is kind of becoming the new lock-in. Whereas before it was, oh, you use the MP3 driver that somebody licensed, therefore you can't play MP3s unless you pay, you know, this German company X amount of royalty money. Whereas these days it's kind of more about, you know, you write your application to only consume this particular queuing service, and we're going to charge you $1 per message. So once you've written that, you're kind of locked in, and moving from that provider to another one kind of inherently becomes quite hard if you've only coded against their APIs and you've locked yourself in. So that's kind of one of the major goals for the project, is to make sure that people don't tie themselves too deeply to a particular provider, and also make sure there's equality between private and public providers.
You mentioned something before that I wanted to bring up, which is containers, which are becoming so hot right now. Makes me feel like I'm on Zoolander. Containers, they're so hot right now. But they are hot. We've talked about them. You know, I mean, probably two of the biggest topics we talk about on Floss lately, it seems like, is cloud and containers. And so how does this support containers? Because containers aren't necessarily a cloud infrastructure. So how does that tie in?
That's a great question. And actually, we have some announcements coming up around this. So we've got a new version coming out very soon. There's a community pre-release available, which is version 1.0 pre-1. So if you want to go online and download that. You can get it on PyPI. The same thing we did with Compute, we've been looking into with, it's not so much the containers, it's the container cloud, which is now being called Containers as a Service, or CAS. So the idea is that you go to a provider, and there's about three at the moment who've adopted this. Joint have a service called Triton. Google have a container service called GKE, and Amazon have one called ECS. And it's basically like Docker as a service. So you can say, I want to run four Nginx containers, and you talk to their API and you say, go and deploy me four Nginx containers. And they come back and go, okay, done. Here's the IPs. Which ports do you want to expose? So the same thing we had with VMs, we now have with container clouds. So what we've tried to do with the new container APIs is offer people a way of talking to these new container clouds with some kind of consistency. So, you know, the cloud providers obviously either didn't learn the lesson or didn't want to learn the lesson about making standard APIs and any kind of consistency between themselves. So, you know, this thing's only been out for a matter of months, and already the differences are completely huge already. In terms of how you describe the containers you want between Amazon and Google, for example, is pretty enormous. The other thing we've done on the private side is introduced a provider for Kubernetes, which I believe was a past episode. And also, if you just have Docker running. So if you just have Docker running on your laptop or just the one server, you can use libcloud to say, go and deploy me some containers. I can probably hear some of the viewers thinking in their heads, why wouldn't I just use the Docker CLI? And Docker, whilst has the majority, I guess, of the container space at the moment, is not a standard. And there are some other container platforms coming around. CoreOS has one called Rocket, for example, which we're kind of looking into at the moment. They haven't finalized their API, so we've kind of stayed away from that for now until that matures a bit more. But with the container provider for libcloud, what you can now do is say, create a connection to my Docker server. So that could be your laptop, for example. Creating a connection to the Amazon Elastic Container Service. Okay, so now you've got two instances. You've got two classes, and they have the same methods. To the one on your laptop, you can say, deploy container. And this could be from the Docker Hub, or it could be from a private repository. You can say deploy container Nginx, and it gives you back your container. And then in Amazon, you could say deploy container Nginx using the same methods. It's consistent across both. And you get back two containers. You get the IPs of both, and then you can create a load balancer to kind of span across them. Or you could set up your DNS records, for example. So one of the things we're looking for, and this is one of the parts of being, I guess, an Apache project, is we're looking for feedback from the community about the API design specifically. This is an early pre-release, and the goal was to try and figure out a way of abstracting these new container clouds, which is quite a challenge because they're very new, and the space is probably going to change quite a lot over the next couple of years. So we looked at what was in the market. We looked at the research in terms of where the market is going, and we kind of put together a design, elicited feedback from the community, put together a prototype, tested that pretty heavily, put together four different providers, which were Docker, Triton, Kubernetes, and ECS, and then basically offered those and released that as a package. So if any of the listeners are thinking, okay, that sounds pretty cool, there's one caveat. The drivers were supposed to be POC, so I'm sure there's hundreds of bugs in them. but it is open source, so if you want to fix them, knock yourself out. But the idea is more about getting feedback about the API design. So do you find the methods easy to use? Does it really make sense to you? Does the documentation make sense? Which is a harder thing of open source, in particular in the sort of GitHub era, where everything works on pull requests. So in terms of making changes to a project, people kind of tend to make change requests in the form of a pull request, which is code. And if you want to make a sort of a broader change, people tend to submit code. And the project and the project committee and the community, it can be quite hard to just look at a bunch of Git commits and figure out how it works and try and think whether that makes sense. So it has been a challenge, I think, in this case to try and get feedback from the community when I've just said, here's my pull request and here's just a dump of all the code that we wrote. Does this make sense to any of you? This time, actually, we've had to kind of put some product hats on and think about, let's make some presentations and do some talks about how it works and I guess try and explain a bit better to the community instead of just saying, read the code.
So how hard would it be for somebody who's just starting out to join in the project then? I hear you mentioned you can just send a pull request, but would there be any need for, maybe talking about what features need to be implemented, or can somebody just write a driver and submit it?
Yeah, so the typically with Apache projects, they use the Apache infrastructure. So in this case, we use the Apache Git servers. One of the things, one of the main developers in the project, a guy called Tomas, he was on this show about 4 years ago, I believe, 5 years ago, episode 181. So if anyone wants to go and listen to that and see a sort of blast from the past in terms of where the project was 5 years ago. And he kind of realized that GitHub was gaining popularity, and with typical Apache projects, if you want to commit to the project, then you have to become a committer and you have to have an Apache address. So you have to be registered as a user. That whole process puts people off, especially nowadays where things kind of work around Bitbucket and GitHub. So what Apache has now is a clone from the Git servers to GitHub. So if you go on github.com/apache/libcloud, that's a mirror, a Git mirror of our actual repository. If you want to make pull requests to that, whether they just be single line fix, you're more than welcome to do that. And one of the things we think is really important as a project is just being open to the community and being welcoming to new people making changes to the project. I think it's very important that people who want to contribute to your open source project are sort of made to feel appreciated and welcome and like you're approachable. Because at the end of the day, it doesn't belong to me. I just happen to be on the PMC. It doesn't really belong to anybody, and that's kind of the point. It's an open source project. It belongs to the community. And if the community want to contribute, then the community can contribute. It does get me very upset when I see, for example, there was there's a big language that's being developed at the moment, a functional language. And I saw a pull request on their GitHub page where this guy had obviously spent a lot of time coming up with this really cool new feature and proposed it as a design. So he'd made a pull request and said, I've been thinking about this new feature. I've implemented this. Can people come back to me with their ideas? And the main developer on the project just replies with two letters, -1, which in kind of GitHub speak just means no, thumbs down, I don't like this. And he just didn't give any explanation. And stuff like that, I think, really puts people off big open source projects, is where there's kind of a quorum of people who are very kind of fixed in how they want the project to work and what the standards are and how things need to be. And if anyone comes in and they want to propose something slightly harder, something slightly different, they just get the, like the Emperor in Gladiator, where he just gives the thumbs down, kind of a -1 reply from one of the main guys. There was a good talk a couple of years ago at PatchyCon about this, actually. And it kind of talked about this idea of, somebody makes a change, somebody makes a pull request, and you'll probably see if you go and look at it, we get about 2 or 3 pull requests a day. So it's a reasonable volume. Some of the people are beginners. Some of them are more sort of experienced libcloud users. Some of them are experienced Python users that have never really used libcloud before. So there's a range of people. And to all of the pull requests, normally the first comment is, thanks for your contribution, which sounds simple, but it goes a long way. And then, have you thought about XXX? So normally it's we do a code review, and we notice that maybe some of the tests could be improved. Maybe in terms of the way they've done the code, maybe it could be done slightly differently so it's more readable. So it's more constructive feedback, which is really key. And I think that's one of the ways to kind of evolve a proper community and to get the community to care about the project. If people find it hard to make changes to an open source project, and they feel like, you know, they have to convince the quorum and convince the main committee of people that their code is worthy, then really it just puts people off. It leaves a bad taste in people's mouths, to be honest. And I think some of the big projects definitely have a lot to answer for that.
Well, not just the big projects. I have actually noticed that seems to happen a lot in the open source world, if you will. That's why I wanted to ask you. I do know if you wanted to go into submit some code into the Apache backed project, you do need to go through a little more effort, right? And it's good that you guys have GitHub. Have you actually seen any more, you know, randomly abandoned clones or forks of your project though?
Not so much anymore. A few years ago, I think that was the case. I did kind of see. Some sort of abandoned clones. With GitHub these days, you tend to have lots of forks lying around, but that's perfectly fine because that doesn't really give you any overhead. Also, the nice thing that we have with GitHub now is we have a whole bunch of code checks and code reviews that are automated. We run all the unit tests automatically, and we've got that set up so that when people raise a pull request, they get a little traffic light. So it goes orange and then it goes green or red. if it goes red, that means that one of the tests has failed. So they've introduced a new bug or one of the tests needs to be updated. And then also we check things like PEP8, which is a style guide for Python. It's one of the original PEPs. So we kind of automatically check consistency and styling and stuff like that. So if there's something that you've introduced which doesn't comply with the styling, then at least it tells you automatically without somebody having to do the reviews. So GitHub is really helpful for that. And they have got some really great features which help, committers and reviewers. Typically with an Apache project, if you're committing a major feature, so... and normally as an organization, you'd have to sign what's called a individual contributor license agreement, or an ICLA. On our project site, we have a note saying if you want to submit a major feature, then typically we'd request that you sign an ICLA. In practice, however, most of the contributions people make are a lot smaller. So sometimes it's a new driver or some extra features to a driver, in which case you can just raise a pull request and somebody will get back to you.
Anthony, I really like what you were talking about before about not being a pain in the butt, let's say, to keep it family friendly when you're replying to people. And I think you have a personal story about that for one of your first open source contributions. So maybe we'll get to you, we'll let you talk about that in just a minute when we come back from our ad that we're going to do right now. By the way, do you support DigitalOcean? Do you support that?
Yes, definitely.
That's wonderful.
It's one of our more popular drivers.
That's awesome. That's awesome because I don't know if you know about this, but whether you're developing an app, a website, or working on a server-based project, you need flexible, reliable, and affordable hosting. And guess what? DigitalOcean, there's the connection, offers Droplets, which are virtual private servers that can be customized and deployed easily to host websites, web apps, production applications, personal projects, virtual desktops, and almost anything you can think of with full root access, something that we love as developers. We really appreciate them including that. This helps you get your project off the ground quickly and makes it easy to scale when you find success. DigitalOcean is used by over 600,000 developers. You can deploy and configure your droplets via a streamed control panel or simple API. You can choose your OS. They support Ubuntu, CentOS, Debian, Fedora, CoreOS, and FreeBSD. That's great. Select from one of the many pre-configured one-clicks like Drupal, Docker, Node.js. That gets you up and running quickly, or you can build the exact infrastructure you need with root access to servers running 100% SSD storage in state-of-the-art data centers around the world. They have an extremely active community with a large and detailed set of tutorials on all the ways you can use your droplets. You want to configure a LAMP server or set up a virtual desktop or VPN? They've got you covered. And it's easy to get started. You can deploy an SSD cloud-based server in as little as 55 seconds. DigitalOcean has incredibly affordable and straightforward pricing. Servers start at only $5 per month. There's also hourly pricing available starting at less than a penny per hour. But we're going to make it so that you can get started today and deploy an SSD cloud server for free. All you have to do is visit DigitalOcean.com, create an account, and once you confirm your email and account information, go to the billing section and enter the promo code FLOSS for a free $10 credit. That's plenty to get you started and explore what DigitalOcean can do. That's DigitalOcean.com, and once you sign up, enter the code FLOSS, that's F-L-O-S-S, in the billing section to get your $10 credit for free. And we appreciate their support of FLOSS Weekly. So LibCloud does support DigitalOcean, which is awesome. But getting back to what we were talking about before, you had an experience, I think, if you're willing to share with us about one of your first contributions to open source software, where maybe what you were talking about before kind of actually played out in real time for you.
So I guess it's probably one of the first, it's the first major open source project I was involved in. It's about 10 years ago, I think. This is before GitHub, when things kind of ran on SourceForge. I probably should mention specifics. It was a driver for a popular open source PBX system. And basically, it was a way of using Cisco proprietary IP phones with this PBX. So it was all written in C. Somebody had put together a driver, which was, you know, they'd done a great job. And, you know, it's quite a typical story. Somebody, very talented developer, sits down for a couple of months, hacks something out, gets it working, puts it on the community, puts it open source and goes, here you are, here's my project. People start to use it. And after a few months, you know, people make improvements, they find bugs. And what was happening was that because that original developer wasn't accepting any kind of contributions, patches, changes to the code, if you wanted to use the driver, the unofficial installation method was to go and download it, go to this URL, download this diff file, go to this URL, download this diff file, go to this URL, download this diff file. And basically it was just a long list of all these patches that you had to download from random people's websites and apply in a particular order in order to get the actual source code that worked. And in terms of getting in contact with the original developer, it was just impossible. So one of the great things about open source is that, you can just turn around and go, I'm going to fork your project, and it's basically going to have all the community branches, and we're going to improve the way that the community engagement has been done. That started off. But what you really ended up with was, you know, two copies of more or less the same project. And then the forked project then got more engagement from the community and kind of evolved. And I guess a lot of the development work went on the fork. And the original project remained kind of stagnant for the next, I think it was about 2 years. So there's a lot of discussions online about which one do you use, and if you use the community one, you get all these additional features. And they kind of started to drift further and further apart. And then a number of years later, I think it was the original developer, then forked our fork of his fork, and then created it, and then pulled it back, and then created a competing fork. And the two things were kind of fighting against each other at that point, which is really unconstructive. And in no way helpful to the community. I'm sure people have the best intentions, but you know, in cases like this, people just want a working driver and they just want their software to work. And in terms of who, you know, the original developer got credit, we followed the same process. But it's just silly things like this that I think that put people off open source. And it did kind of put me off in the early days because at this point I was still a student. And, you know, I was, you know, spending a lot of time developing C and C++ projects. And I saw something like this and I was just like, okay, if this is how the open source world works, then, you know, I think I'll just stick to running my own projects and talking to people directly instead of having to worry about, you know, giving credit to particular people and massaging people's egos. And it does kind of put people off. I think things have changed over the last 10 years, especially with some of the newer languages. So Python is so much easier to use than C and C++. Any of the viewers on this call that have that know how to construct make files, you know, utter respect to all of you. It's not straightforward. And you know, especially doing it from hand as well, is hours of painful work. And, you know, working with the GNU make tools in different distributions is hard. And by no means was it straightforward in the early days when really there wasn't any information online about how to do it. I just had a library of books that you had to consult. And if it wasn't in the books, then you just had to figure it out. But nowadays, you know, we have these languages which are a lot friendlier, a lot easier to use. I think we've heard from the Go team, for example. Go is a really nice kind of alternative to C. I'm probably going to get thrown stuff from C developers. But in terms of Python as well, it's really easy to use. There's no make files. In terms of getting that to work on different distributions, it's also a lot easier. So I think what's ended up happening is that the open source community hasn't just become people with, you know, 10, 20 years of C++ experience and Java experience. You know, we've got different people from different languages, from different backgrounds. Some of them are beginners, some of them are more experienced. And now, you know, you can be a beginner and you can get involved in an open source project. You know, we'd have heard it from Kubernetes, for example. You can go and raise a pull request for Kubernetes if you've only been learning Go for a couple of months. And even trying to do that 10 years ago would have been next to impossible.
Of course. I have noticed. I went through a very similar story. But in my case, it sometimes seems to be never-ending if you want to look at it that way. I guess there's a lot of projects out there that still act that way towards new contributions. I guess it would probably be let's say a way to defer, you know, drive-by submissions. Is there anything in place for you guys to handle that, or do you require contributions to be kept up? Like, if I were to write a new driver, would I be required to keep it up and keep it maintained?
No, we don't have that requirement, actually. You know, obviously we encourage people to do that. But if you only have a fixed period of time and you want to contribute the code, then great. If it adds features and functionality to our ecosystem, then that's more than welcome. And we understand as well that open source typically means that people have a day job and they're doing this in their spare time. Which sometimes gets forgotten, I think. And if people have made the time and they've made the effort to contribute, then I think that should be celebrated. However, you know, we have some sort of commercial products that do do rely on libcloud. So we have to maintain a fairly high standard, I guess, in terms of code quality and test coverage and things like that. So if with drive-by contributions like you're talking about, we'd only really accept those if they came with unit tests, and the unit tests also had mock tests for the API with all the correct fixtures and stuff like that. So at least we know that what's being contributed is has been properly tested. Another principle is that we won't merge anything that we're not really ready to release. And this is more sort of typical now with the projects where they've got a much shorter release cycle. So at the moment, we're releasing every 2 months. And if every 2 months we had to go and basically review all the stuff that had been merged and retested, or that would take us another 2 months. So we won't merge stuff unless we think it's ready for production. So it's just, one of the things that we maintain.
With 52 providers right now, have you come across any deprecation issues? Do you need to remove services that went away? And if so, how do you guys handle that?
Yep, so that is coming up now, actually. The next release, we've got to remove a couple of providers, an Australian one called Ninefold, which shut down recently. HP Helion Public Cloud, which had just been shut down. So I guess this is where public cloud providers have decided that, we spent all this money and we're not getting the right level of return. So we're just gonna stop running it. So I mean, the driver is gonna stop working anyway if the API has been shut down. But what we're doing in the next version is, if you call the factory method with that provider, then we're gonna give you a warning if it's due to expire soon. If it has shut down altogether, then we'll basically raise an error saying this driver has been deprecated. So you'll get a more sort of a user-friendly, I guess, message that this will no longer work.
Is that getting pulled from a server, or where exactly do you get that information to from somewhere over to the library? I'm guessing you don't ship that out with every release, do you?
No, it hasn't been. So if you're using an old version and you're trying to speak to HP, it's not going to know that HP has more recently shut down. So in the next version of the driver, we are going to introduce those error messages, I guess.
Oh, that's a good idea for somebody who wants to get into the project start writing that in there. What about mentoring? Does your I've noticed that a lot of big projects, in this case, for example, I did a lot of work for KDE, and they have like this excellent system for mentoring. You get assigned somebody to help you with your, in this case, we can say pull requests, but any contribution you're planning on making. Do you guys have something in place like that?
We don't have an official process. Quite typically, and if you follow us on Twitter, it's at libcloud, you'll kind of see people, and we keep an eye on people who are discussing the project, people who are thinking about making contributions, and one of us will normally offer a hand and say, if you need any help, tag me in the pull request, or just come and reach out to me directly, and I can help you through things. We are working on Google Summer of Code, so Apache is a partner of Google Summer of Code, and we've been doing that for a number of years. So we have sort of mentoring through GSOC. And also in October last year, with DigitalOcean did a really cool initiative called Hacktoberfest. I don't know if you guys covered this back in October. But basically, if you raise either four or five, you register on the website and you give them your GitHub account. And if you raise five pull requests in October, you get a free T-shirt. So I was probably kind of cheating because I'm involved in about 10 projects, but I managed to get my free T-shirt and I wear it with pride. But some people who are new to open source, it was kind of a really good encourager for them. And libcloud was one of the not sponsors. It was one of the projects that was listed on the site as a welcome to beginners and friendly to beginners type project. And we did have some contributions from people who were involved in the Hacktoberfest initiative. So hopefully they're going to run that again in 2016. So in October, people can look out for that. And also Google Summer of Code, we will be involved in as well.
Nice. And well, let's talk about the API. We've mentioned that before. You did say that the project's written in Python, right? And we also agreed that C and C++ is completely, you know, superior in every way, I would say. I'm not sure if we agreed on that, but let's say we did for a second. Are you guys planning anything aside from Python for the API? Maybe like a SOAP or REST API?
So that is a great thing actually about this project in particular, is that there are there's kind of a growing ecosystem of both products and open source projects that take libcloud and then wrap something around it. So let me talk about an example. SaltStack, which is a past guest, have a product called SaltCloud. And SaltCloud basically gives you a command line where you can say deploy to Amazon, deploy to, as of yesterday, Dimension Data. And you can kind of give it a YAML file with all your infrastructure in. And you can describe, I want a server called Web1 and a server called DB1. And I want it to run in this cloud. And you just give it a file, and it will go and deploy it for you. And under the covers, for most of the drivers, for most of the clouds they support, they use libcloud. So if you're not a Python developer and you want to take advantage of the multi-cloud orchestration, then SaltCloud is a great way to go. Also, another past guest, Stackstorm, have a really cool kind of wrapper around projects like this, which is they have this workflow tool, which is based on OpenStack Mistral, which is a workflow engine and a DSL written in YAML. So you can actually describe workflows in YAML to do the libcloud functions. So things like create server. So you can create a workflow, and there's a demo of this on their site somewhere actually that I help them with. You can create a workflow that says when there's a Git commit, because they have triggers, go and deploy a server in my cloud. Go and log into it, and then go and install Salt or Chef or Puppet, and then run sort of the Chef apply commands, or go and run a recipe in Chef, or go and apply a configuration in Salt, and then set up a load balancer. So you can kind of tie together the different features of libcloud in a workflow, which is really cool. And I've seen some great examples of that. If you want to use something like Java, then I'd say look at the JClouds project. If you're a Ruby developer, then definitely look at something like Fog. There was a REST API put together by Google Summer of Code a number of years ago, but it hasn't been maintained since then. There's another project that consumes libcloud called Mist.io. Mist like Fog. And that project also offers a REST API, so it's a mobile application for managing your different clouds and keeping records of what servers you've got, and you can deploy servers to different clouds. So that's like the easiest way to get started with libcloud would be just sign up for a free account on their system, and you're using it out of the box. You don't need to do any coding at all, so you're kind of taking advantage of the project. But yeah, in terms of a REST API, Mist does provide that, and that's something I'd definitely like to see this year from the community is maybe in the Google Summer of Code is a REST API written in Swagger and integrated some sort of automation to generate the Swagger files based on our API structure so that it can kind of be maintained more or less automatically. So that'll be a fun challenge for somebody out there who wants to get involved.
Yeah, definitely. Any other new features that are coming up for you guys? I know you mentioned the kind of graceful handling of outdated APIs or drivers. Anything else that you're working on that people should be looking out for?
The biggest feature is the container stuff, which I've spoken a bit about before. So, you know, we're hoping for and looking for feedback on that. Also, we just want to get some ideas from people about how far up the stack we should go. And this is, I guess, one of the big questions in the project, which is, you know, we offer some of the more low-level cloud features like VMs, DNS, load balancers. These are more your kind of infrastructure components. If you go the whole way up the stack to the PaaS, so platform as a service, you've got things like queuing, databases, things like that. It's very difficult to create an abstraction between them because each provider is so different. So I don't think we'll necessarily go that far up the tree, but monitoring would be something that personally I'd love for us to implement, because if we had monitoring in there, then all of a sudden we could create these really cool mashups between the drivers where we could create auto-scaling across multiple clouds just using libcloud. And I think that would be awesome. You know, if you could detect that your VMs in this provider are going slowly or this provider itself is offline, then automatically spin up some servers in a different provider. That'd be a really cool thing. So if people want to engage with us on that discussion, or if someone just wants to go ahead and propose the design, then that would be great.
So what if they wanted to do that, what's the first step they would take in order to propose that or start working on that? I mean, I know you mentioned there's a certain amount of governance in terms of unit tests and things, but if someone has a great idea like the monitoring, for doing the monitoring, do they just reach out to you or do they go to the website? How do they do that?
Yeah, they would go to the website. On the website, we've got a link to the developer discussion, what are they called now, distribution lists. So you subscribe to that on email. And then if you want to ask questions just to the developers in general, it's a fairly broad community of people. So it's not just the people on the PMC and the chair who typically sort of answer quite quickly. But there's also the other developers and other people who get involved. So there's a few hundred people on the distribution list. So if you want to ask people questions or just bounce around ideas, that's a great place to start. On the website as well, if you go to the documentation page, there's a whole guide for contributors. So we kind of describe what you need to get going, what the typical workflow is, how to test the project, how to check for syntax and stuff like that. So, you know, we've documented that process and we give people that up front. So at least they've got everything they need to get started. And then also we do accept what is becoming known as a WIP PR. So this is a work in progress pull request. GitHub has a nice feature which they introduced quite recently where you can raise a pull request, and in the pull request message, you can actually provide a to-do list. There's a slightly bizarre syntax to do it, so you'll have to Google this. But you can raise a pull request and call it WIP, design for monitoring API, and you can provide a to-do list saying provide API implementation, provide some example drivers, provide documentation, and that can just sit there in our you know, in our pull request queue as a WIP, and we can see that somebody is working on it, and then at least we can provide feedback as they're developing and as they're coding. People don't need to go and write this whole thing offline and then go, here you go, what do you think? We can kind of open that whole thing up a bit more.
Oh, cool. That's a great tip. I use GitHub, but I mostly as an end user pulling software down to run as part of a program or something like that. So I always love to hear those cool tips like that about GitHub, because it seems like such a useful tool. So appreciate that. We do have a couple of questions that we have to ask at the end of every episode. So get ready. These are tough questions. They're going to be hard to answer. You're really going to have to put your thinking cap on. No, I'm just kidding. The first one is, what's your favorite scripting language?
I've been thinking about this for a while, actually, because I knew you'd ask me. It's a challenging one. And as Randall's not on the program this week, then I can definitely say it's not Pearl. No, I'm only kidding. I'm a big fan of, and I'm probably going to lose all credibility by saying this, of Windows PowerShell.
Ooh, really? That's okay.
I've spent a lot of time with a lot of languages and a lot of scripting tools, and as a language, it's been very well thought through and very well designed. If somebody were to take the same ideas from PowerShell to make it open source and to get it to run on cross-platform, that would be awesome. Like, as a project, I think that would be so substantial. They've kind of borrowed a lot of the learnings from a lot of the nice features from things like Perl. So the ability to do things in shorthand, to, you know, pipe things between commands, but also everything doesn't have to be a string like it does in Bash. You can pipe more complex objects and lists and dictionaries and stuff like that. So they kind of got a mashup between some of the more complex features of Python and some of the crudeness of Bash and Perl, and they've kind of created that in a way that's really easy to read. The code is readable. That's a good note.
Huh, that's really interesting. I would have never guessed that you were going to say that in a million years. So I appreciate the explanation too, because I was going to ask you, what the heck? wow, that's great. Well, okay, so let's get on to the next question. We don't want to start another episode about PowerShell. What is your favorite text editor? And I'll also open this up to IDEs if you have a favorite IDE you like to use.
It changes week by week. So my editor of the week is Atom. Which is pretty cool, and it's gaining some popularity, mainly because there's actually a really good set of plugins. I've been using a lot of editors where they have a plugin ecosystem, but no one's really contributed any. Atom's definitely different. I got very sick of switching editors depending on which language I was writing. So during the week, I'm probably writing about three or four different languages. So having to run four IDEs and editors at the same time is a bit of a memory hog. So it's nice to just to be able to use one finally.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Anthony, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about LibCloud. I know I'm interested in it. There's people in the chat room that are saying that they're really interested in it. I think it's a fantastic project. So thanks for coming and sharing with us.
Great. Thanks, guys. Good to speak to you.
Great. You bet. So that's Anthony Shaw. He's on the project management committee for LibCloud. And pretty cool stuff. What do you think? What do you think, Guillermo? I can talk. I really can.
Well, my middle name is also Anthony, so you can also use that, I guess. I kept turning around whenever somebody mentioned Anthony today. So I like the migration aspect of this, since this is basically an abstraction layer over, you know, all those services. It would make things a lot easier if you just need to switch, let's say, from Amazon. Their prices went up, and you want to switch over to, let's say, the Google version of Elastic Cloud or whatever. It does sound like a really good way of not locking yourself into any particular service.
Yeah, definitely. And the fact that it's not just one or two, the fact that they have like 50 of these things that they support is really, really cool. So I'm really impressed with what they're able to do. So I hope people go out and check them out. Speaking about checking things out, you should check out our upcoming episodes of Floss Weekly. Let me tell you what's coming up on Floss Weekly soon. Next week, February 9th, we've got OpenStack Astera. It's a network orchestration service. So keeping in the cloud theme here, designed for provisioning Neutron managed virtual network functions as an OpenStack deployment. So sounds complicated from that description, but I will see. It sounds interesting. I believe they just changed their name too. It used to be something else, Aconda or something like that. And then coming up after that, we've got Ledger with an H in front of it, which is simple, precise, future-proof accounting software for techies. And of course, it's open source, so you're not going to want to miss that. And then after that, on February 23rd, something I'm really interested in is a project called OpenAV Productions. OpenAV. And this is kind of a sound mixer. They have a bunch of different sound tools. If you like Fruity Loops or those kinds of things, or if you're a DJ and you want to use open source software, it's going to be really cool. I think John has some samples from their drum mixer that they did. Here we go. Yeah. Nice. And they have different drum packs and things, and this thing plugs in with different architectures. So you can use it with Ardour, you can use it with Open Studio, things like that to keep everything open source, which is really cool. So be sure to tune in for that. Also, if you like tuning in to Floss Weekly, you're going to want to sign up for the new newsletter, which is out, which is you can find out more information on that at twit.tv/news/newsletter, I believe, if you want to sign up for the newsletter and you know kind of keep in step with everything that's going on the Twit. TV network. That's a great thing to do. So that's coming up soon, and you're going to want to check that out as well. Guillermo, where can people check out things that you're working on?
Well, there is my Twitter account that is at @GAMARAL. I never talk to myself, so it's kind of hard to write that down in my brain. And I also have a YouTube channel, which you can search for me. Same thing, Gamaral or Guillermo Amaral, whatever what you see right here, here and here. Should also work. I'm not the DJ guy. Unless you like his music, then sure, that's me. And what else? I guess that's it. I did want to thank people who came to a scale and said hi to both Randall and myself. I'm glad everybody enjoys the show, and I would like to thank you on the show this way. So thanks. That's it.
That's awesome. Yeah, I love going down to scale. I haven't been there in a few years, though. I need to get back down there because it's such a cool conference. And I love to give them shout outs whenever we can. So I'm glad that went well and that you were able to meet some people. As far as what I'm working on, you can follow me on Google Plus. That's probably the best way. As you can see, you know, down here, you can follow me there. Just look for Aaron Newcomb on Google Plus. You can also, if you're in the Bay Area, especially, we're working hard right now on the Benicia Mini Maker Faire, which is going to be really cool. It comes up on April 16th. You can actually buy tickets right now, and you get a discount for buying early at BeniciaMakerFaire.com. One of the things that I'm working on is a laser maze that's going to be new this year. So we're going to have if you've ever been to Monterey or some of those places that have little laser mazes that you crawl through and you try to get to the, you know, get a good time, get to the button and get a good time. You can do that. So I've been working, especially the past 24 hours, I've been kicking out the script for, the laser maze. And, it's pretty cool. You can actually, well, I'll tell you more about that. Maybe I'll bring it on Twit at some point to one of the shows, and we'll do a little demo of it because it's really, really cool. So I think that's about it. If I can't think of anything else, but look forward to Randall being back soon and hosting the show. And thanks for watching. We'll see you next time.